Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. Far from the Earth. It's the furthest man-made object from Earth. It's traveling 17 kilometers per second away from our sun. It's currently over 100 billion kilometers from Earth. That's more distance from the Earth than to the sun. Voyager was launched in September of 1977, and around 2012 it was said to have broken into interstellar space. That means that it's now outside the influence of our sun. Voyager, both 1 and 2, came equipped with a golden record. This is an attempt to explain life on Earth to extraterrestrials, seeing as how Voyager 1, thanks to a massive gravity assist, is now the furthest, fastest moving object from our planet. This seems reasonable. I've been a huge fan of the Voyager program since I first heard about it, and recently, a few old buddies of mine from college and myself grouped up to try to track Voyager 1. We have all since graduated with degrees in physics, engineering, mathematics, and theoretical physics. One of us went a little overboard on our degree and got the PhD. I'm the engineer, just to clarify. The Voyager 1 probe was tracked by amateur radio operators in Germany using a 20-meter, which is a 66-foot dish. We decided we were going to do something similar. We knew we'd need to find a radio telescope capable of such an undertaking. It's moved over 4 billion kilometers since 2006, and in doing so, we needed to be sponsored. And we have some sort of goal that would make a marketable splash. Well, we came up with a pretty hefty goal. We were going to receive data, a transmission from the data tape recorder on Voyager 1. The instrument is scheduled to power down for the last time in 2015, maybe slightly before or after. This being a hefty goal, we knew our work was cut out for us. After a few months of searching for a sponsor, we finally located an entrepreneur based on the East Coast of the U.S. who was willing to take us on. I will leave his name out of this. Safe to say he has a few billion dollars to his name and an eye for science. We'd be using an array of 25-meter antennas in the southwest U.S. to track Voyager 1. Again, I'll be leaving the names out. Several months later, after much preparation, various calculations, projections, and mathematical assumptions, we were ready to hit the array and begin our search. We would probably have collaborated with NASA and been given some of their data, but we wanted to rerun the exact course of Voyager 1 as it passed by all of its goals, factoring in the massive gravity assist from Jupiter. We wanted to see just how close our math was to actuality. It was part of our experiment. Close doesn't cut it in space. Thankfully, we're almost dead on. Even then, it still took several days to actually confirm that we had, in fact, located Voyager 1. Once this confirmation was received, at some time around 2:30 a.m., pizza slices were thrown into the air, Mountain Dew, and a few glasses of champagne were chugged, and cheers sounded between the four of us and a few other radio operators who happened to be nearby and knew what we were doing. Here's where things became odd. On tracking, we recorded two distinct thuds, roughly 1 hour after we verified our target. There shouldn't be anything out there. Particles would gravitate away from the general vicinity of the Voyager probe unless an outside force had acted upon them. It didn't seem like much, but from our calculations, assuming the 1,590-pound mass of Voyager 1 on Earth, the thuds were the equivalent of 150-pound force hitting the probe each time. We were sleepy, groggy to say the least. None of us had ever done anything like this before, and most of us wanted to just crash. So we left the recorder on and called it a night. At 5 a.m., a radio tech came screaming into our room, saying something was wrong. "You killed Voyager," were the exact words. All of us bolted to our previous stations, and well, we sat there. It takes a long time to communicate with something that far from Earth. Mechanically speaking, hardly anything had changed with the probe. The gyroscope was off, but stable, not uncommon by a few fractions of a degree, and all of the hardware seemed to be in working order. The now very pale radio tech proceeded to supply us with a recorded telemetry from the events that sent him running. It began at 4:37 a.m., when a much larger thud than before was recorded, the one being the equivalent of a 500-pound force slowly nudging into Voyager and becoming stuck there, essentially. It wouldn't damage the probe unless it was moving much faster. Voyager then goes dark. I mean, completely. It's like it no longer exists. Until 4:58 a.m., a few minutes before we were woken from our brief slumber. Nothing had happened since then, according to the other graveyard shift operators in the room. We all had headphones on, listening to the tracking. It was also being recorded. Suddenly, the static cleared up completely. We all shared a look, assuming the worst. Clear static tends to mean we've been disconnected or we've lost track of the probe. After a few seconds, seemed like an eternity, we hear another dull thud. Then a scraping sound. Some of these sounds are inferred due to the age of the data tape recorders, but we all heard them. May as well have been recorded next door. Goosebumps prickled my skin as the headphones began to play the most eerie sound I could imagine at the time. The recorder was running, and I knew I need to analyze whatever was making this distorted sound more than once to make sure I hadn't lost my mind. The sound was like a needle landing on an old-school record player, except that new music or audible noise followed. There was more scrapes and suddenly silence. The static began to come back, and we heard another series of thuds. Now, at this point, as you can imagine, we all have come to the same conclusion. There is something on Voyager. Something other than us has interacted with the probe. We all sat there dumbfounded, staring at each other, wondering how this was going to hit the scientific community. How we'd prove it. How many people would tell us we were crazy. And what the hell were we going to do next? Our sponsor arrived in the complex at the moment and informed us that we were to tell no one. Our contracts had a clause in the fine print on one of the numerous pages that we'd all assumed were legal bullcrap. He owned the rights to anything sort of data pertaining to a non-human interaction with the probe. I'd assumed that had meant an impact of some sorts. The probe was moving at 17 kilometers per second, and there are other objects in space. I didn't have a thought otherwise. Each of us sat there and let what we'd just been told sink in. Suddenly the static cleared one final time, and the hair on the back of my neck stood straight up. The telemetry I was receiving indicated that Voyager had gained roughly 80 kilograms if it was on Earth, and that it was moving about the surface of the probe in such a manner as to cause the internal gyroscope to make corrections to keep the probe upright. There is no up in space, but the probe has a manner in which it moves through space, and that was being disturbed. Through the now crystal clear transmission, I heard a few more knocks and then silence. The crackle came back, and we were forcibly removed from our posts by a few men with guns, claiming to be company security. After we left, we were given the possession that we'd kept in our bunks since the start of our research, sans anything technological, of course, and warned again of the legal and illegal repercussions we would endure should any of us expose what had happened. We briefly tried to reunite, but every time we'd talk to each other, via phone or internet, we'd find ourselves followed and monitored. I once found a bug in my car and told my friend that enough was enough. We just have to let this sit for a while and let things work themselves out, even if none of us liked it. Reluctantly, we all parted ways, and slowly I began to go on with my life, all the while knowing that there was something more out there, something undiscovered, and something that had the capability to interact with a probe launched from Earth more than 40 years ago. This thought haunted me until I received a fax, yes, a fax, in 2014 from my theoretical physicist friend, using a code we'd learned in early college as a joke. The code was difficult to decipher when spoken, and quite cumbersome when written. I recognized it immediately for what it was. I was elated to learn that he had been in contact with our other friends, and that he'd arranged for us to meet secretly on our old college campus. Once there, he revealed to us that he had been secretly storing data on a USB drive attached with a long cable laid on the floor of the control room for the array that had been connected to a small label printer. He was always a conspiracy nut, and this time it paid off. He told us that the thuds we were hearing could actually be interpreted as an antiquated version of Morse code. The thuds and scrapes could be converted into dots and dashes using length, force, and location. We used an old laptop that my friend had acquired off the books to analyze the data on the flash drive and to determine what message we were receiving from Voyager before we had left, if any. The result terrifies me, that a creature of some sorts could gather intelligence from radio signals we've been broadcasting into space for years, and using Voyager 1's golden record as the key, that it could leave a message for us. I learned to write things in a pseudocode to avoid being censored by those watching me. It's not that hard anymore. They've been more lax lately in monitoring my communications, and as long as I leave keywords and phrases out, I can do nearly anything online. The above is a warning. As we put the data together, the message was revealed. It said, "Hello." Keywords can be hard to hide. I'm writing this from a laptop from 2002. It's the only thing I could find that was not bugged in my house. I think it's because of the now very dated internal setup, or it could be the OS, or it could be that they just don't think I'd be able to fix it. The thing has been a doorstop since 2008 or so, and I haven't had a use for it until now. I programmed a code to alert me to possible hacks, and thus far it's proven safe. Lately, I've noticed more and more people following me. The guys who'd been following me have either become secret agents or have been relieved of their duty. It's not hard to tell if you're being followed by someone who's not really trying to stay hidden. Same black SUV, same route, same time of day. I waved at them once. They sarcastically waved back at me. Not anymore. Last week, a nondescript pickup has been tailing me. I only noticed it because I have an eye for trucks, and I liked the kit that had been used to level it. Had a nice ride height. Eventually, however, I spotted it more than once a week, always well off into the distance, but sticking with me even when I change routes. It's only ever come close enough for me to see inside once, and the windows were so heavily tinted that I could only make out a dark silhouette. Discreetly, I managed to meet with my physicist friend, and we got in touch with an old professor of ours. For their safety, though I fear it may already be too late for some, I will leave their names out. The professor was very hesitant to believe what we'd found out on our first foray into tracking space probes. But once he saw the hard evidence, we had confirmed contact with Voyager 1, and then the mysterious thuds, he granted us access to the university's radio telescope. It's not nearly as powerful as the array we used previously, but we could at least attempt to reach Voyager 1 to see if anything had changed. Now, unfortunately, Voyager was out of our reach. However, we were able to track the space probe Dawn. The professor suggested this as it was an active probe in the inner planets and was still en route to its next mission objective. Dawn is a probe that tracked an asteroid named Vesta and was then reassigned to visit a dwarf planet in the inner solar system, Ceres. Since it was still en route to Ceres, it was relatively easy to track and receive telemetry data from its journey. The Dawn seemed completely normal at first. The probe was right on track for the course NASA had laid out for it, no weird thuds or any other such disturbances. On a whim, we decided to look a few weeks prior at Dawn's data. Dawn had a more modern recorder and could store a great deal more than Voyager 1, simply in the onboard computer. What we found turned my stomach inside out. Hurtling through space at nearly 9 kilometers per second, Dawn was impacted by a relatively speaking large object. It rounded the spacecraft and caused the thrusters to be activated to make several course corrections. It was the same size as the one that had impacted Voyager. The data available to us from Dawn indicated that it left another message via Morse code on the spacecraft. We can only guess that this creature learned Morse code via the various messages that Earth has been broadcasting over the century and a half plus that we've been using the code. Shortly after the message ended, something large passed within 20 meters of the Dawn. It was generating its own gravitational field. Yesterday, I prepared to drive to a store and encrypt the data in case something happened. Sure enough, there was a loud bang outside the door, right as the data finished copying. The four of us shared a brief look, and our elderly professor showed us how to exit the building using a maintenance door that led to an underground pathway used by professors and grad students teaching lower-level physics to the main lecture hall. He elected to stay behind and see what happened, or slow them down. Once outside, we did our best to blend in with the university crowd. There have been a few moments in life where I feared more for my life. Not many. Little by little, we crawled across the campus. I knew that we had to get off campus, but whoever had followed us obviously knew what vehicles we drove. I decided we should take our professor's car. He loaned it to us before. I knew where he kept his spare key, and once I'd located his hide a key fake rock, we knew we had a shot. We headed for the faculty lot with key in hand and couldn't see anyone following us. Kindly, luck was on our side. The drive off campus was uneventful, but the remaining three of us needed somewhere to compare the data. None of us knew Morse code off the top of our head, and due to the fact that we were all terrified to look it up on our phones, lest we turn them on and alert who or whatever was tracking us to our current location, we rode in silence to an off-campus library. They had free Wi-Fi, and this has since served me greatly. Latitude and longitude. The message contained the latitude and longitude of our exact location when we first contacted Voyager 1. They knew exactly where we were. It also held the galactic coordinates of Earth with respect to the sun. My pulse quickened. I felt like we were being watched at every moment. We agreed to split up and communicate only by fax, as we deemed this was the safest route. Knowing someone who owns a cabin deep in the woods 20 miles from a paved road has its perks. It's small, so it doesn't even split the tree canopy. I've been staying there and using a borrowed Jeep since then. It's probably not going to last long, and I assume I'll be found out one way or the other, but I've had a good idea where I'm going to go next. Should that need arise, I hope they give me another week at least. Sometime, I'd need to go home to gather supplies. I also wanted to grab all the food I could, my fax machine and my rifle. I needed some sort of protection. I went right at dusk. Poor visibility and the falling darkness would hopefully mask my movements. Stopping for supplies would put me at great risk. I parked a Jeep across the street so as not to draw undue attention to my house. While I was in my bedroom, I noticed a window was cracked. I never opened windows. I religiously kept the windows and shades closed in the house at all times. I would not have done this. I grabbed my rifle and continued gathering supplies. I wasn't in for a fight and was hoping to just get out as quickly as I could. When I entered the rec room, I saw the back door was ajar. The deadbolt had a habit of sticking if you tried to shut the door from the outside, and apparently whoever had been here prior had left in a hurry. I began to move at a much quicker tempo. Retreating into the garage to grab my hiking pack and the last of my canned stores, I saw something out of the window. It was just a glimpse, but something large slipped past the window right as I opened the door. I immediately regretted not closing the back door in the rec room in my haste. I had to go through a small hallway that connected the two rooms, and if whatever I saw made it out back, it could easily slip in the back door. I crammed everything in my pack and loaded the rifle before I opened the door. Sure enough, the black silhouette of a person stood in the now completely open doorway. I fired one round into the doorframe above and made a run for it. I got into the Jeep and let it drift down the hill without starting it. Thankfully, it was a stick. Before the turn at the corner, I lit the vehicle up and tore off. As I punched the gas, I noticed something near the passenger mirror. Jeeps aren't quick, nor do they have a lot of acceleration, but something was running alongside the Jeep at a roughly 50 miles per hour. It took a swipe at the Jeep, and I swerved hard to escape it. In my haste, I drove completely off the road and into a field. Driving through the field wasn't hard. I knew where I was, and the Jeep had four-wheel drive, but I kept seeing things in the field. People? No. I can't say for sure. I never got a great look at them, but I wasn't about to let them get close enough to the Jeep to take a swipe at it again. Less than a minute later, I made my way back into a road, and within half a mile, I was on the interstate headed for the cabin. I was pretty sure no one had followed me past the feeder street to the interstate. They didn't seem to be able to keep up at that point. I made it to the cabin and immediately locked the door and began to board up the windows. There was some leftover lumber in the rafters. I was down to the last window when I thought I noticed something outside. As I toggled the light on and off, the thing moved closer. It was 7 feet tall or better, and it kept just out of view for the most part. When it was 20 feet away, I turned the light off one more time. When I turned it on, I expected to see it standing in the window inches from my face. Instead, it kicked the door off the hinges. I fired once directly at it and missed, of course, but actually gave it pause. The thing looked like a person, kinda. It had long fingers and larger eyes than normal. They seemed to peer deep into me. It pointed at me and stalked back out of the door. I boarded it up and didn't sleep the rest of the night. I post this from a library Wi-Fi while I drive past in traffic. Hopefully, word will get out. I hope this helps. Snaps is the name of the game. A-E-I-O-U. There's no code. Not for me, at least. I was left no secret message this time. I've been holed up in the woods for just 2 days and they found me. I didn't see them often, but once in a while at night I'd glance out the window and see something move behind the burn pile or see a shadow slink away around the side of the cabin. I'm sick of it. My whole life has become one night terror after the next. I left the cabin early this morning and I'm glad I did. I saw one on the way out. It looks just like a normal person. Could have been anyone I'd ever met or known at some point or another. Except they're not like us, and they're not human. They're fast. I only saw it a second, and suddenly it was on the hood trying to claw through the windshield. I damn near rolled the Jeep, trying to shake it. Using the steep hill to my advantage, I slammed the brakes and managed to slide the creature onto the road in front of me, where I promptly ran it over. I had the data I needed. I knew where they were going, more or less, and I needed to get there quick. Based on our group calculations, they'd be here soon, and I wasn't about to miss this opportunity. If they were using the gravity assist I'd calculated, then they'd land near the array shortly. I had no time to spare. Something felt wrong. Was I being followed? Had I forgotten something? I'll admit, I hadn't been entirely honest with my friends. They had probably been captured, or worse. I was driving around a Jeep that, at this point, was probably considered stolen, and I really don't have much else to lose, but I needed to keep going. As I settled into the seat and pushed the Jeep into fifth gear, I noticed movement in my mirror and saw a car behind me, flashing its lights. Either he wanted around me in a hurry or something was wrong. I made to pull over, and so did he. I suddenly noticed that my backseat was irregular and bumpy. There was one in the Jeep. I knew it was there. Did it know I knew? As I slowly reached for my rifle, the car behind me sharply rear-ended me, sending the figure in the backseat flying into the front. It grabbed my shoulders with hands that turned to claws and hissed something at me. It was a sound like a lizard testing the air with its tongue. Luckily for me, I had the rifle in its throat as soon as it wheeled on me. Unluckily for me, it jammed for one reason or another. I skidded the Jeep onto the shoulder and did my best to leap into the field. The thing came with me, only it must have been trying hard to pin me because it overshot and rolled well past me onto the pavement. I've never moved faster in my life. I was back in the Jeep and hauling down the road when it first latched onto the side. Instinctively, I pointed my jammed rifle at the thing and pulled the trigger. This time, the gun fired, and the creature was suddenly holding on with an arm that was no longer under its control. It crumpled to the ground, and I sped away. Once I arrived back at the array, the memories came flooding back. I knew what I needed to do, but I didn't have much time. The place was virtually destroyed, and I had to navigate the interior with a small mag light. The bunks where we once stayed to study were a thing of the past, while the array itself remained untouched. The deeper underground I went, the more devastated the compound appeared. It was almost as if the place was hit by a bunker buster. Once I was 3 stories underground, I saw the first shadow. I knew what to expect at this point and immediately ducked behind an overturned desk to try to wait till it passed. Once the thing was well around the next corner, I carefully got out of hiding and continued my descent. The flashlight began to give out, and I knew it would only be a matter of time before I was found. Once on the fifth and final underground layer, I was in a near-complete darkness. I cleared through the devastation to an isolated door just like any other. It was locked. As I struggled with my homemade lockpick, I heard a scraping sound in the direction I'd come. To my horror, at that exact moment, above the noise and drone of the surrounding complex, an audible click sound echoed from the door I was working on. Of course, it still wouldn't open. The scraping sound drew closer. I finally was only one pin away from having unlocked the door when it rounded the corner. There, less than 50 feet from me, stood a massive creature. It took up nearly the entire hallway. I could see it heaving, but even in the relative silence, I couldn't hear it breathing. I jammed the pick back as far as it would go and managed to shimmy the door open just in time to swing myself around the opening and slam it shut. I locked it and scurried away as quickly as I could. The door was an entryway into a larger lab, untouched by the impact outside. If my guess on the design was correct, then there would be a small capsule ready for launch and a tube leading directly to the surface. That would be my escape. As I began to look for the data I was after on their lab computers, I could hear the massive beast outside the door attempting to burst in. I knew my time was limited. The thing has made its way through the outer door, but apparently was unable to breach the heavier inner one. This, however, proved to be a short-lived victory. The creature had alerted more to the disturbance, and they were using some torch to cut through the door. I don't know if I'll have time to finish. I need to gather as much data as possible before I leave, or I won't make it. I write this from one of those very computers as it downloads the information I need from various international organizations. As soon as it's complete, I will leave. I'm happy it's over. I enjoyed being here. I've learned a great deal. I hope you have as well. I have what I need now. Farewell to the dearly departed. It was an unseasonably warm spring day in 1983, and I was celebrating my 14th birthday. Now, while most kids my age would have been eating cake and shit, I, on the other hand, was trying to avoid having my head removed from my shoulders by chainsaw-wielding Colombian hitman. I wholly blame my father, Herman, and even possibly Tony Montana, for this revolting predicament. Herman and I were handcuffed to the shower curtain rod side by side, enjoying a little father and son time while Uncle Donnie was trying to get the chainsaw operational. Uncle Sanchez was oblivious to the technical difficulty, so engrossed was he in raping my stepmother, Betty Jo, and her fat ass. Betty Jo was screaming, but I think it was mostly a charade for Herman's benefit. Betty Jo put the Heidi Heidi in ho, and if Herman was in denial of that obvious fact, it was no skin off my back. However, decapitation, yeah, that was a whole other enchilada. How did it come to this, you ask? Well, let me tell you. This is my tale. Herman and Betty Jo were a couple of ex-hippies who had made the transition from weed and acid to coke, along with the rest of America in the early 80s. Herman had always been a wannabe drug kingpin, but three things kept his success firmly at arm's length. Things that kept Herman's from being a successful drug dealer are, one, he definitely gets high on his own supply. Two, he let his degenerate customers run tabs, and three, he could never remember who owed him money, let alone how much. Herman was forever getting overcharged by his suppliers or fronting shit to his customers who never failed to wash. Herman's head, which had never been a technological wonder to begin with, was by 1977 fucking toast. By 1983, it was burnt toast. He was always 3 months behind on the rent. He hid all his money in a box of Eggos in the freezer. He hid all his drugs, where he was convinced nobody would ever find them, under the mattress. Yeah, Herman was some other kind of genius. But in all fairness, Herman did try to instill in me what you might call the entrepreneurial spirit. When I was 13 and asked for a new boombox for Christmas, he told me, "If you want shit, kiddo, you should start dealing weed." Herman even magnanimously offered to supply me at cost. Betty Jo, who never worked a day in her life, unless you count sucking schwanz, was all for this. She never failed to remind me that Ronald Reagan was never handed anything by his parents. I ended up getting a job in a pet food store, but that ended when Herman came to visit me at work one day and offered my boss an 8-ball of some really primo shit. "Herman, you dumb fuck," I said. "What even made you think he was a dirty cokehead like you?" "Yeah, I know, kiddo, but it's some primo shit. Sniff, you want to try some?" I was fired that day, but was nevertheless grateful my ex-boss didn't call the cops. I asked my mother if I could live with her, but she informed me her new boyfriend wasn't really a kid kind of guy. She suggested I get a job and rent an apartment. I suggested I was 13 and she should see psychiatric help. She suggested it was all for the best and I would thank her when I was older for the tough love, whatever the fuck that meant. Herman suggested I start to contribute to the household by weighing shit out, folding bundles, and making deliveries. "You're 13, it's about time you started pulling your own weight, kiddo. Gas, grass, or ass, nobody rides for free." "Yeah," Betty Jo said. "What he said goes double for me. You think Ronald Reagan would have freeloaded?" "I don't know, Betty Jo. Why don't you ask him next time you're bobbing on his nobbin?" "Herman," she gasped, "did you hear what he just said to me?" "Kiddo, you gotta respect Betty Jo." "Well, Herman, how about you and Betty Jo go fuck yourselves and the horse you rode in on?" Well, it seemed I'd gone too far because when I had come home from school the next day, my key no longer fit the lock. I rang the bell, footsteps approached. From the other side, Betty Jo said, "We've changed the locks. You are no longer welcome, kiddo." "Let me speak to Herman, Betty Jo." "Herman is 100% with me on this one, you little disrespectful shit. So beat it. Maybe the army will take you. Ronald Reagan lied about his age to fight Nazis when he was 13. Rather than debate the Gipper's war record, I simply squatted down on the welcome mat and pinched a rather impressive loaf. It seemed I was persona non grata. Boiler room. With nowhere to go and nobody who wanted me, I knocked on my best friend Monty's door. "Monty, I'm out on the street," I explained. "Yeah, dude. Mom is like all strung out and shit, so I don't think she's going to be really down with house guests, but, you know, I got to get the key to the boiler room." Monty's dad was a super of my building and a frequent customer of Herman's. Rather than attend to building maintenance, he mostly just snorted blow and drank old English 800. When that got boring, he'd beat Monty. His mother and Monty's 11 brothers and sisters, just to change it up. Monty's dad was a busy man. "I'll take him," I told Monty. So for exactly 3.5 weeks, I lived next to the boiler in the recesses of the basement of my apartment building. Mostly, I read comic books, listened to the radio, and herked my gherkins. When that got boring, I thought of ways to off Herman and Betty Jo. Monty was a real pal throughout my entire ordeal. He'd bring me food he stole from his fridge, mostly Wonder Bread, American cheese, and a good day Twinkies. Then near the end of my 4th week, an exile to things of note happened. Things that happened. 1, my school finally got in touch with Herman and told him that if my truancy continued, he could expect a visit from social services. And 2, the boiler broke and I got busted. So it was on my 14th birthday that Monty, his dad, and Herman paid me a visit in the basement. Monty's dad was understandably upset. Not that I'd been living in the boiler room, but rather that I'd been using the corner of the basement as my personal toilet, and it was admittedly getting somewhat rank. "Come on, kiddo, we're going. Betty Jo says you can come back to the apartment till you can find a job and move out." Now, normally, I would have told Herman to go fuck himself, but the truth was, baby whites could only cut so much mustard, and I was smelling pretty ripe. "You're a regular prince among men, Herman," I said, gathering up my comics, radio, and pillow. Monty's dad, however, wanted me to clean up all the shit and piss before I went anywhere. "Hey, don't you owe Herman a couple of thousand smackers, coke boy? Why don't you just hire somebody to clean that shit up and take it off your bill?" Monty's dad looked at Monty and said, "You go get a fucking mop and bucket, Monty." Monty gave me a very dirty look and I immediately felt guilty. That didn't mean I wasn't going to clean that shit up, but I was going to feel bad about it. So it was 5 minutes later, Herman's key was unlocking the front door. I was dreaming of a shower, clean BVDs, and a square meal. I intended to throw my clothes right down the incinerator. They were so rank. As Herman and I stepped into the apartment, I felt cold steel press into my neck. "You fucking walk to the shower, man, or I'm gonna fill your fucking head with mucho lead, motherfucker." It was Uncle Johnny and Uncle Sanchez. Of course, they weren't really my uncles, but that's what Herman told me to call them ever since they started supplying him with coke a few years ago. "Johnny, man, you know I'm good for it," Herman pleaded. Sanchez punched Herman in the face, and Herman went down like a blind roofer. Sanchez pulled him to his feet by the hair. Herman's beard was covered in blood. Herman sputtered and spat out a few teeth on the hall runner. Sanchez braced him. Sanchez punched him in the beezer. More blood spurted. I silently thanked Sanchez, but I knew none of Herman's comeuppance were on my behalf. Sanchez would rip your balls off with a pair of pliers and then solder your ass with a blowtorch just as soon as he would fuck your wife in the ass while he made you and the family dog watch. Uncles Johnny and Sanchez marched me and Herman into the bathroom and promptly handcuffed us side by side to the shower curtain. Rod. Betty Jo was already handcuffed to the toilet sans panties, and now that Uncle Johnny had Herman and I bound to his satisfaction, he gave Uncle Sanchez the green light to resume his work on Betty Jo's Ronald Reagan loving ass. Uncle Johnny dumped out a big pile of coke on the rim of the sink. He put his big oily nose to it. He then vacuumed up half of it in one noisy pass. Betty Jo screamed a little louder, and Uncle Sanchez said, "Yo, man, I think she fucking like it." "Yeah, you like that shit, Betty Jo," Uncle Sanchez asked rhetorically while yanking her head round by the hair. Betty Jo and I made eye contact, and she said, "Ronald Reagan would at least have had the decency to turn his head, you little freeloading bastard." "Well, God bless America, Betty Jo." Uncle Sanchez put his gun in Betty Jo's mouth and simply said, "Suck it, BJ. Suck that sheet." Betty Jo obliged, a little too enthusiastically, if you ask me. Herman's black eye took it all in. Herman clucked his tongue against the roof of his bloody mouth. "Come on, John." Uncle Johnny punched Herman in the face. "Sanchez, give me that fucking chainsaw," he ordered. Uncle Sanchez extricated himself from Betty Jo's posterior and returned with a Black & Decker chainsaw. He handed it to Uncle Johnny and resumed ingressing Betty Jo. "No, man. Don't you... Come on, Johnny. Herman, you fucking me? Come looking for you? You owe me money, man." "I told you, Herman, you don't want to fucking owe Uncle Johnny money, man." "Yeah, man, but..." Uncle Johnny kept trying to get the chainsaw going, but his expertise in the field of home improvement seemed somewhat lacking. Finally disgusted with the dysfunctional chainsaw, he launched it over his shoulder. It thudded squarely onto Uncle Sanchez's cabeza. "Johnny, man, you just fucking hit me! You just keep doing what you're doing, Sanchez!" Uncle Johnny put his gun in Herman's mouth. He looked at me with ojos locos and said, "You got something you want to say to me, kid?" "Nope," said I in a toward the force of word wizardry. Uncle Johnny shrugged his shoulder. "Well, say goodbye to your daddy, kid," Johnny said, cocking the hammer back. I took the ball of my left puma and wedged it against the heel of my right puma. It wasn't going to be easy, but time was not on my side. I had been keeping the laces of my pumas tied extra tight for the past 2 weeks. The aroma that could level Tacoma had gotten so unbelievable that I had to beg Monty to scrounge me up a can of Lysol. I had been religiously spraying my pumas and ankles with Lysol every hour on the hour for 2 entire weeks. Just in case you have no idea what I'm going on about, consider this. Teenage feet that haven't left the same pair of pumas nor socks in almost a month. We are talking about Guinness book-worthy foot odor. Yes, the Brahmdosis nebulae has been discovered, and it was in my pumas. So as Uncle Johnny threatened to ventilate Herman's head, and while Uncle Sanchez rode Betty Jo like nobody's business, I made a birthday wish and pushed as hard as I could on the heel of my right puma. It slowly started to give even as I felt the skin breaking. It might have been easier to get off the cuffs around my wrist, but that wouldn't have proved nearly as effective as the Cold War payload I was about to unleash from within the silo that were my Pumas. Yes, I like to think Ronald Reagan would have approved of me doing my bit in the never-ending war on drugs. With a final desperate push, my right Puma went flying right into Betty Joe's stupid face. What happened next was a blur. Herman, Uncle Johnny, and Sanchez, and Betty Joe all turned distinctly green around the gills. They collectively screamed and gagged. Betty Joe projectile vomited right into Herman and Uncle Johnny's face. Herman puked so hard his head butted Uncle Johnny's accidentally. Uncle Johnny's nose spurted blood. Uncle Sanchez tried to shoot Herman, but shot Uncle Johnny in the shoulder by accident. Uncle Johnny turned round and shot Uncle Sanchez in the head 5 times. As Uncle Sanchez's head exploded, he dropped his gun. It went off and shot Uncle Johnny in the stomach. Uncle Johnny's gun clattered to the bathroom tiles while he clutched his gut, inspecting his new belly button with apparent incredulity. I put his head in a scissor hold like I'd see Mr. Fuji do on Channel 9 wrestling. Uncle Johnny clutched at my legs in vain. After a long minute, he collapsed to the bathroom floor and didn't move again, while Herman and Betty Joe continued to puke and moan. I got the shower rod loose and slid my cuffs out. I found the keys to the handcuffs in the dead Uncle Sanchez's back pocket and extricated myself promptly. Betty Joe, who was still handcuffed to the toilet, said, "Kiddo, get me loose." "Ronald Reagan would get himself loose," I said. Herman sat on the bathroom floor crying and dry heaving. I managed to get my other Puma off, which set off another round of gagging. Herman tried to get the keys to the handcuffs from me, but I opened the bathroom window and launched them into deep space. I picked up one of my Pumas and tied it around Betty Joe's neck. She screamed, hissed, and then sobbed. I rubbed it in her face. "You mess with the Puma, you get the stank foot." I then turned to the shower and grabbed a bottle of Mr. Bubble and proceeded to cover myself from head to toe in a deep, luxuriant lather. "Herman, get me loose. You fucked Sanchez. I had no choice. You were liking it." "Was not. Was too." When I had rinsed and repeated no less than 3 times, I turned off the water and left the bloody bathroom. 10 minutes later, I was fresh dressed like $1 million. I put on my favorite Kangol and fly red socks, took Herman's new sneakers still in the box, and tried them on for size. A perfect fit. Goodbye, funky Pumas. I went into the freezer and got what I quickly counted as $17,000 out of the Eggo box. Happy birthday to me. I put the cold cash in my knapsack along with some comic books. I then took Herman's stash out from under his mattress. I walked back into the bathroom to find Herman passed out and Betty Joe still struggling to free herself. "Kiddo, get it off. Get it off. The horror." "Don't worry, Betty Joe. Help will trickle down one of these days. I just know it will." I picked up Uncle Johnny's gun and put it in Herman's hand. I aimed it at Betty Joe. "Kiddo, you know I love..." Bam! Betty Joe's third eye winked at me as if to say, "Even Ronald Reagan couldn't have done better, kiddo." I then helped Herman put the gun in his mouth. "Sorry, Herman. Betty Joe wouldn't want to ride off into the sunset by her lonesome," and squeezed the trigger. I tore open a bag of Coke and poured it all over Betty Joe's head. "Nothing to gain except killing your brain," I said. I then bade farewell to the not-so-dearly departed, along with my funky-smelling Pumas, and started the first day of the rest of my life.